Mr. Mullins.
Thank you. May it please the court. Counsel. My name is Brian Mullins. I represent Anthony Moore on this direct appeal of his conviction in the Southern District of Illinois for distributing at least 50 grams of crack cocaine and for possessing a firearm after he had been convicted of a crime punishable by more than 1 year. We've raised five issues for appeal. One of those issues is whether the Fair Sentencing Act applies retroactively. That issue has been decided adversely against us, so we won't be addressing that issue today. One of the other issues is whether the court should have granted a mistrial in light of contact that a juror had with a spectator and a relative of Mr. Moore's. And unless there are questions regarding that issue, I was going to focus on the three other issues that we have raised, which I think are all somewhat related in that we believe they amount to cumulative error of essentially the district court admitting what amounts to what we would consider character evidence that was tangentially relevant, if at all relevant. And the district court, with respect to the 404B evidence and the evidence of the pit bulls taken from Mr. Moore's residence, did not engage in the weighing of whether the probative value of that evidence was outweighed by its prejudicial effect. So,
well, with respect to the prior felony conviction, there was no stipulation that he had a prior conviction, so the government had to prove he was convicted of a crime.
Correct. There was no stipulation, so Old Chief didn't apply. But I think the method by which the government introduced that conviction went into prejudice the defendant to the extent that it didn't need to introduce a videotape of the conduct that constituted that conviction.
But was there a request that the conviction be admitted but with no reference to what the conviction was for? Did the defense request that it come in that way?
There was not. There was an objection to admitting the evidence under Rule 404B. And so there was a general objection made to introducing that evidence.
Right. I mean, once the court had ruled on that, but that is a way that, that it could be sanitized. That request wasn't made.
There was not, I don't believe.
The judge himself referred to the previous events as 404B evidence, if I'm not mistaken. And the government's position is that it, at least to some extent, it has to come in. It's evidence of the previous convictions, and for that reason, it's not 404B evidence at all. Correct.
Right. That is the government's alternate theory of admissibility. And we acknowledge that the government needed to prove that there was a conviction for a felony, but that could be proven quite simply by introducing the judgment through, in this case, I believe it was Detective Almarode, who was the officer who conducted the controlled buy. And I think he could have certainly testified to the conviction, identified Mr. Moore in court.
Williams's question. That there appears to have been no objection along the lines of you're introducing this in the wrong way or you're introducing this in an unduly prejudicial way, invoking Rule 403. Was there an objection along those lines?
There was not. There was simply an objection under Rule 404B.
And that 404B was irrelevant because this evidence proved an element of the offense. So the right objection would have been 403, that it was being introduced in an unduly prejudicial way and could have been introduced in a cleaner.
Correct, and that objection was not made, so perhaps the court needs to address that under a plain air review. But I believe that even under plain air, Mr. Moore was prejudiced by the evidence, in particular the way it was admitted. The government in this case had no controlled buys during the period of the conspiracy from 2002 until 2007, but it was able to introduce evidence of a controlled buy from 2000. And not just the evidence, or not just the testimony of the detective or the person who engaged in the controlled buy, but a videotape of that controlled buy, photographs of the controlled buy, and the actual crack cocaine, which amounted to more crack cocaine than it was actually admitted that had been seized during the period of the conspiracy.
And when the court indicated it was going to admit this evidence under 404, and particularly the second buy, and it was clear the court was going to do that and give the limiting instruction. Was there any kind of request made as to the basis that it was going to be admitted for, the court making certain findings about that?
Well, there was discussion at the pretrial conference of the defense's objection to admitting that evidence. The district court did not discuss at the pretrial conference the basis for which that evidence would be admitted. And we argue that.
That was my question. I mean, was there at any point where the defense said, look, we understand this is what the court's going to do. You need to, we were asking you, Judge, on what basis are you, you know, for what purpose is it being admitted to make those findings?
And I believe that argument was made in writing. I don't recall it specifically from the pretrial conference, but there was a response to a motion in limine by the government, a response by the defendant, and I believe that argument was made in writing before the final pretrial conference. And I think it has to be considered that the issue, the matter in issue here, was not whether the item was crack cocaine versus powder cocaine, or whether Mr. Moore intended to distribute rather than just possess the crack cocaine. The issue was whether there was a buyer-seller relationship as opposed to a conspiracy to distribute. And the other issue was essentially whether the cooperating witnesses were telling the truth. So credibility was crucial here. And also the buyer-seller relationship was crucial. And I don't, the evidence was admitted according to the jury, or the instruction that was provided to the jury for the defendant's knowledge, intent, and opportunity. But I don't see how that evidence is relevant to the defendant's knowledge, intent, and opportunity to conspire to distribute crack cocaine rather than just engage in a buyer-seller relationship. The factors this court says are relevant with respect to whether a buyer-seller relationship exists versus a conspiracy are whether transactions are in large amounts, whether there is prolonged cooperation between the parties, whether there are sales on consignment, whether there are standardized dealings, and whether there is sharing in the profits. And neither the transaction with Mr. Irwin or the transaction with Mr. Smith show any prolonged dealings with either one. They were discrete sales of small amounts. So I don't think that those transactions were relevant to a matter in issue, which was whether there was conspiracy here. Now, with respect to the evidence of the pit bulls, that evidence was admitted to show that Mr. Moore had an ownership interest in the residence at 1110 Prairie Avenue. But there was numerous other witnesses who provided that evidence.
But there were also witnesses who testified to the contrary as well, right? The defendant offered evidence, if I recall correctly, that that in fact he wasn't an owner.
Correct. He did present a couple of relatives, I believe a cousin and his father, who said he did not own the residence. So certainly the government needed to prove to present some witnesses who would connect Mr. Moore to the residence. But they had done that. There were 11 other witnesses who connected Mr. Moore to the residence. There were utility bills. There was a employee of a communication service provider who said Mr. Moore had requested telephone service at the residence.
But here the difference on this dog rescue evidence is that Moore himself claimed ownership of the 1110 Prairie Avenue residence, right?
Correct, but he also claimed ownership.
So that's a little more direct than the other 11.
Well, I think the utility bill is pretty direct. When a utility bill is sent to Mr. Moore at that address, and when he's requesting telephone service at that address, I think that's direct evidence that Mr. Moore is connected to the residence. The other witnesses, some of the cooperating witnesses testified that they saw Mr. Moore at the residence.
You think his admission is more highly has higher probative value than
some
of these others?
It has some probative value. But I think its prejudicial effect outweighs the probative value.
And I assume there was no proposal to stipulate on ownership either.
No,
in other words, you
could
keep it out. You could keep it out, obviously, if you stipulate that he's the owner.
Correct. There was no agreement to stipulate on ownership. That was certainly a major issue in the trial. And we acknowledge that the government needed to make that nexus. But it didn't need to do it through evidence of dogfighting, which I submit was in evidence. I think the government would disagree with that, but Ms. Hughes testified that she was from the Animal Control Department. She testified that the Animal Control Department's job is to rescue dogs that are abused and who are sometimes engaged in dogfighting. The documents that were admitted as evidence from the Animal Control Department, according to the record, referred to dogfighting. And I think the context of the time, and I think Mr. Michael Vick's trial, given their, his sentencing, given that it had been only 5 months before this trial, is relevant because I think dogfighting was particularly in the public consciousness at the time, and it is the kind of issue that I think arouses emotions, particularly, and that's the kind of prejudicial effect that Rule 403 is all about.
Wasn't there some evidence that in this case the property itself was referred to as Murder Avenue?
Correct.
Wouldn't that be a good deal more prejudicial than a reference
there,
to
people's? There were a lot of references to Murder Avenue, and I believe there was a discussion of trying to limit that, but I think the court found that that was what it was referred to as, and so we've not raised that issue on appeal. But I think combined, all of these errors do raise cumulative error, and this court has held that perhaps individually one error might not be enough to create error that isn't harmless, but when taken together, the cumulative errors can add up and deny a defendant due process, and that is what happened here. Now, with respect to the reference to gang affiliation, I think it was prosecutorial misconduct because I think the question was, or at least should have been known to the government, that it would have elicited a response that referred to gang affiliation. And I think just by Mr. Smith referring to another gang that Mr. Moore wanted to pay dues suggested, first of all, that Mr. Moore and Mr. Smith were in a gang that was a rival of this gang that was selling drugs in Mount Vernon, and that Mr. Smith had some kind of leadership role in this gang if he were able to, if he had enough power to order another gang to pay dues. So I think that directly violated the district court's pretrial order to avoid gang affiliation. This court has said that gang references have to be, there's a substantial risk of unfair prejudice attached to gang affiliation evidence. Noting such evidence is likely to be damaging to a defendant in the eyes of the jury, and that gangs suffer from poor public relations. And careful consideration by district courts in determining the admissibility of gang membership and gang activity evidence is therefore required. That's from United States versus Irvin, which we cite. And here that careful consideration was done by the district court, but then the district court kind of dropped the ball, I believe, when the government did elicit gang affiliation evidence and the district court did not order a mistrial. Unless there are further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Certainly, Mr. Mullins. Mr. Norwood.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. I will take up the issues in the same order as counsel. With respect to the 404B evidence or the buy, there was no stipulation as to the defendant's prior felony conviction. This is the first felon in possession case I've had where they did not stipulate to that. Actually, the second where they did not stipulate to the prior felony conviction. Normally, the stipulation would just say the defendant had been convicted of a crime punishable by more than 1 year without any reference to the nature of
right. Right. And when counsel refused to stipulate, counsel understood that what would come in then was not only a record of the conviction itself, but also the videotape, photographic evidence.
Counsel had all the discovery, so I assume that he would have realized the government would have to put on evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was in fact convicted of the offense, which was the predicate felony.
The reason I'm asking this question is that from what I can tell, it appears that the record of conviction, but the evidence of the offense conduct was all referred to below as 404B evidence.
It was, and at the time of the pretrial motions, again, I was dealing with defense counsel whether we were going to stipulate or not, so I assumed there was going to be 404B evidence since there wasn't going to be a stipulation. There turned out not to be one, so we had to put it in for other reasons.
But had there been a stipulation, you would have sought to admit it in any event. Is that
then
right?
It would have been strictly 404B at that point, yes, Your Honor. The other thing that's important is that there is another Anthony Moore in Mount Vernon, and that Anthony Moore also happened to be involved in drug dealing. and is, I believe, currently on supervised release. So it that's not in the record of supervised release, but there was another Anthony Moore that was, I believe, on page 3 of the trial transcript. So we had to show not only that Anthony Moore had a prior conviction, but it was the same Anthony Moore that was sitting in the courtroom.
Would you agree that it makes it a little difficult for us to review the district court judge's decision to admit this evidence under 404B when we don't have the reasons spelled out?
It does make your job a little more difficult, Your Honor. Judge Gilbert, I believe at the pretrial conference, just said that it is admissible and he was going to give a limiting instruction, and it's normal practice that before it's introduced, you advise the court you're getting ready to introduce it. He gives a limiting instruction to the jury. But I agree it makes your job slightly more difficult.
Yeah, and there was no request by you to have the court spell it out and to deal with the four-part test that's appropriate under 404.
No, Your Honor, it was in our written motions, but not during the oral part of the pretrial conference.
And he did give the pattern instruction at the time that the evidence came in?
The cautionary instruction, yes, Your Honor. With respect to the pit bulls, the ownership of the house at 1110 Prairie was at issue. There was a motion to suppress filed prior to trial by the defendant. The government's response to that was, unless the defendant admits ownership in this residence, he has no standing to suppress the evidence found there, which consisted of guns, drugs, and scales, and plastic baggies. The defendant, at the time of the motion to suppress hearing, withdrew his motion to suppress because he did want to contest the ownership of that property. So the ownership of that property was at issue. Judge Pallmeyer is correct. The defendant put on 4 witnesses, including the defendant's father, who said it was the father's residence and not the defendant, Anthony Moore's residence. In addition, while utility bills and a cable bill might be nice, normally the individual record keeper at the cable company cannot identify the defendant as the person who actually came in and subscribed to the service. In this case, the animal control employee could identify Anthony Moore as being the person who claimed ownership in that residence. And I know with respect to the 2006 transaction, the animal control person said the dogs were taken in part because they thought it was a vacant house. And the defendant said, no, I live there, I stay there. So that's why that testimony was important, to show not only ownership, but the defendant admitted being there at that residence. In addition, in the defendant's case in chief, one of his witnesses even testified they kept pit bulls there at the residence. And that was in response not to cross-examination, but to the defendant's own attorneys asking questions of what kind of dogs were kept there, pit bulls. At the time, I guess Michael Vick, that was around that time, but if these were miniature poodles, the evidence, the animal control person still would have come and testified and said, we recovered miniature poodles from this residence, and the defendant said, this is my residence. That was the purpose of that evidence. With respect to the gang affiliation, I want to be clear, the government did not at any point introduce evidence that the defendant was part of a gang or that he was a alleged self-proclaimed governor of the Gangster Disciples. The government tried to avoid bringing in that information. The government, and I was the trial counsel, and I admit to this court I asked probably a stupid and imprudent question when the witness, Devin Smith, talked about BDs, and I was, well, what's a BD? And when he mentioned it, I'm like, oh, and Judge Gilbert immediately at the next sidebar said, well, it's harmless, don't do it again. Later in the trial, Judge Gilbert, and I put in my brief, Judge Gilbert actually wanted the government to ask a question about what does 7-4 mean, and that information, if asked, would have elicited gang information. The government said, well, I can't do that. The government tried after that point to always say, without any organizations, without saying in the group of individuals, did the defendant do this or do that? So the government tried its best to avoid any gang reference or gang affiliation, but at no point did the government ever say the defendant was a member of the Gangster Disciples or that the defendant was a self-proclaimed leader of the Gangster Disciples or anything to that effect. I think I've addressed the 3 issues that were raised in oral argument by my colleague. The other issue regarding the juror contact is in the brief. If the court has any questions about that, I'll be glad to answer them, but I believe Judge Gilbert handled that situation properly. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Norwood. Anything further, Mr. Mullins?
With respect to the 404B evidence and the controlled by with Mr. Irwin, Mr. Moore did not contest his identity. He did ask a question of the detective whether there was another Mr. Moore in Mount Vernon, but that was not an issue that Mr. Moore raised. And so I don't believe that anything other than the judgment of conviction was needed to be admitted to prove the prior felony. And that's where the district court erred in not engaging in the weighing of the probative value versus the prejudicial effect. And this court in United States versus Naguib, which I apologize, I did not cite in my brief, but I would be happy to provide in a Rule 28J letter, but it's at 56 F3rd 798, decided by this court in 1995. The court held the trial court's failure to indicate how it balanced the 404B factors is an abuse of discretion. And
but we've already concluded that 404B was just not relevant.
Well, it was certainly relevant.
Rule 403 problem. Now, it's true the district judge didn't say anything about Rule 403 either. But it's a little more understandable because there was no Rule 403 objection.
Understood. But although Mr. Smith, the other defendant whose testimony was admitted under Rule 404B, there was no prior conviction attached to his transaction. So that transaction was admitted purely under Rule 404B.
Nothing is ever admitted under Rule 404B. We keep saying that. And lawyers keep filing briefs, as both sides did in this case, talking about whether evidence is admitted under Rule 404B. Rule 404B is a rule of exclusion. Evidence is admitted under Rule 402, which says that relevant evidence is admissible.
I should say it was not deemed inadmissible under Rule 404B. But what all of this evidence, I think, led to was a suggestion to the jury that Mr. Moore was a gang-banging thug who had a propensity to sell crack cocaine, and that was not a relevant issue to determining whether he conspired to distribute more than 50 grams of crack. Unless there are any further questions.
Well, and then even if we deal with 404B, the fourth prong of 404B is whether the probative value outweighs the danger of unfair prejudice. So there wasn't a request specifically. I mean, even if you didn't make the 403 argument, the last prong of 404B makes that a factor.
Yes, it's 403 and 404B analysis is similar in that respect.
Yeah. Okay.
Unless there are further questions,
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mullins. The case is taken under advisement.